You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Hello, welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical, our live version at the Portland Conference, TCG 2017. I'm Rob Weiner, Kent, the editor-in-chief of American Theater, and I'm here with
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And our guest today, our first guest, is Amy Wong of The Oregonian.
Yes, hi. Arts editor at The Oregonian Media Group.
Right. And later on the podcast, we'll also speak to two artistic directors in Portland, Damaso Rodriguez of Artist Repertory Theater and Maureen Porter of Third Rail Rep. So we'll kick off here with a conversation with you, Amy. How long have you been at The Oregonian?
I've been arts editor for the past year. I've been at The Oregonian for about 20 years.
Really? Did they in other positions, obviously?
That's right.
Yeah. Was it always arts coverage that you did? Or
this is my second go-round in our lifestyle slash arts department.
Okay. So I know there was recent headlines about The Oregonian staff, right? About just there were some cutbacks, right?
That's right.
But you survived, thank goodness, right?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the state of arts journalism here, and then more broadly, your take more broadly on the arts scene in Oregon, because you're the arts editor. So,
well, it's not that much different, unfortunately, from the state of arts journalism across the country in that we have seen cutbacks. When I arrived at The Oregonian 20 years ago, we had a full-time classical music critic, full-time theater critic, full-time film critic, full-time pop music critic, full-time visual art critic. Those folks are all gone now. We still have freelancers who contribute very valuable work to our arts and culture coverage. I'm grateful for them every day. They are our eyes and ears in the arts community because obviously with our lessened presence, we can't be as many places as we used to be. We have the good luck of having a very engaged arts audience here in Portland. So we do want to serve them. We continue to publish two print arts and entertainment slash culture sections a week. And we have an arts presence online as well on our website, OregonLive.com. It's discouraging to look nationwide and see headlines like the New York Times eliminating all of its regional arts coverage. Mm. And it sort of gives you the feeling that if the New York Times can't staunch the flow, then what can smaller papers do?
Right, right. And I, in the menu of options that you have to things to cover, theater, is this theater one of the, I mean, how does it fit into the local scene for you?
Theater is a very high priority for us. As folks here know, we have dozens and dozens of active theater troupes in the Portland community. We also know that our readers highly value our theater coverage. In surveys that we've done, they have consistently ranked theater at the top of their desire for arts coverage. So we are committed to that. I personally strive to have at least one theater story per week.
Okay. And on the balance of whether it's criticism or features, is it you're leaning more towards features? Is that
we try to do a blend.
Okay.
You know, frankly, reviews are easiest. You know, you go, you see the show,
right,
you write it up, you're done.
Right.
Doing a preview or doing a feature takes a little more time. I think it's worth it. I just finished editing, and it was in today's paper, look ahead at the summer season,
okay,
which is, you know, like other places, more a little more fringy, a little more experimental, a little more fun.
I'm just wondering, because like you still have like a robust art section in comparison to most papers, and so like when you're talking to your publishers and trying to justify this coverage, like what do you say, and do you have any tips for our colleagues around the country who may be having similar uncomfortable conversations?
So I don't talk directly to the people who make those decisions on the financial side. Like many other media outlets in this country, we are driven a lot by metrics these days. We have, and I'm sure many of you use metrics as well in your jobs, where you can see in real time, in our case, who's reading which stories.
Yeah.
So that has an effect, but we also know that our print readers are very loyal to our arts and culture coverage, so we want to keep them in mind as well. So it's a balancing game, is the short way to say it.
And is it the same as with us American Theater, where the things that get the most clicks are usually like controversy and controversial opinions? Like, what gets the most clicks for you?
Well, certainly when we wrote about the Edward Albee situation, that got a lot of attention. We also get a lot of clicks for things that are really popular and well-known.
Okay.
We did well with access. For example, when The Lion King was in town last fall and we went backstage and talked to the puppeteers, that did very well. That was a Facebook Live.
Wow. Okay. So I was going to ask you how you decide, with only one story a week and a lot of companies, how you decide what to cover. Are you yourself, do you rely on critics to tell you or freelancers? Or do you yourself get engaged in taste making that way?
It's a blend of what our freelancers are telling us, what I'm seeing, and what the theater companies are pitching to us.
Right.
Also keeping in mind that we have a general mass market audience. So, you know, they're more likely to glom onto something that's better known, like Shakespeare.
Right.
Yeah.
Are we talking about the Albee thing now?
Well, it's like Deep just waiting to talk about that.
So, talk about it with someone in Portland.
Since you brought it up.
Okay, so we should recap. And please feel free to chime in if I say something incorrect. So Michael Streeter, who is a Portland-based director, he wanted to do a production of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at the Shoebox Theater. It was supposed to be in September. And he wanted to cast the role of Nick. There's two couples in the play, and he wants to cast the role of Nick, the man in the younger couple, as a black actor. And the Edward Albee estate is very stringent, and before it grants permission, before you can get permission to do an Albee play, you have to have a venue in mind, and you have to have a cast.
Right.
So, and I believe Edward Albee, when he was alive, like he would require headshots of people.
Right, he had casting approval.
And so Michael Streeter submitted the cast for approval, and the estate said no. You have to cast this role in particular has to be played by a white actor. And in full disclosure, while Albee was alive, there have been all black productions of Virginia Woolf, and there have been black actresses in the role of Martha.
And there's just a Chicago company just announced a production of with George and Martha, both African American, but not Nick. I'm not sure why.
Right. And my reporting of the story, the estate was very particular in saying while these cross-racial casting has happened in the past, like we still require approval just so we can abide by Albee's intentions, which were very strict when he was alive and continued to be strict now that he's passed. And with copyright laws being what they are, the casting won't open up on that role in particular until 75 years after Albee's death. So the debate has been, I feel like there's been multiple debates running around. One is on cross-racial casting. When is it appropriate? When is it not appropriate? And these peas are going to kill me when I'm editing this podcast. And then also about copyrights, like 75 years is a very long time. Is that still an appropriate amount of time in order to retain a copyright? And then also, like, what right does an estate have to say you cannot cast an actor because of their race?
Right.
So did I sum that up?
Yeah, and that was the national conversation we were part of. I wonder, how did this play in Portland, where it started, basically, the controversy?
Well, in Portland, you have to put it in the context of the fact that this is the whitest major city in America. And so the opportunities, so you have to start with the fact that there are just fewer actors of color in this community. And then you have to look at the fact that a lot of the, not all, but a lot of the decision makers are going to be white. I would say to balance that out that the folks that I have met in the theater community here are very supportive of the concept of identity conscious casting. And, you know, Michael Streeter told me when I was talking to him for this story that when he was reading about the play on the Samuel French website, he noticed the line that specifically said, and I went and looked at it too myself, yeah, so he's correct, non-traditional casting. And he knew that Oregon Shakespeare Festival was among the companies that had cast a black actress as Martha in the past in a previous production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So he also knew the actor that he was casting, Damien.
Jeter.
Yeah,
Jeter.
Yes, I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
I think it's Jeter.
Okay. In fact, he's working with Damien in an upcoming production at Portland Opera. the David Lang production that's coming up.
Okay.
Where Michael is going to play a slave owner and Damien is going to play a slave. So he wanted to do something a little different with this casting of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And, you know, he and other folks that I talked to all presented this as an opportunity to expand the play a little more.
Right.
And to one person basically used the phrase, bring it up to date. Hmm. And, you know, make it. There was a feeling among the folks that I talked to, which was not the majority of the theater community, I should say, but there was a feeling among the folks that I talked to that the Albee Estate had a right to insist on the integrity, so to speak, of its work, but may have also missed an opportunity to bring the play a little more up to date.
Yeah.
And I believe because casting the role with a black actor also meant you had to change some of the lines in the play, because there's some lines that very specifically talks about Nick's blondness.
Yeah,
he is called blonde and blondie. And yeah.
Blue eyes,
well,
yeah.
The blue eye, you know, I went back and reread the script because I was curious about that. And if I read it correctly, the blue eyes actually refers to Jim, George and Martha's son.
Oh, right.
Okay. The lines that I saw that referred specifically to Nick,
they
refer to him as blonde, and he is called Blondie. But when I was reading it, looking for those references to blue eyes, they all centered on Jim. So that was interesting to me.
I did have this idea, I'll just say, sort of a stunt that I wanted to have Damien come and read some lines as Nick. But Nick, I looked at the play, he doesn't have very many monologues.
No,
he doesn't talk much. He's more reactive.
You know,
he's very present.
And that was interesting to me, is that he's primarily a reactive character.
Yes, yes.
So,
I mean, I would be interested to see that production.
No, and it was so interesting just researching the story and then having all of these different sides. And there's one side saying, we need to open it up and put all of these and make these classics relevant to modern audiences and put these new dimensions into these plays. And then I feel like there's also another side who's saying, why are you trying to make the words of dead men speak what they didn't intend? And why not do things by living writers who are talking about these issues? And so where do you fall? Well, I guess where did the two of you fall into this these conversations?
You want to take that one first?
I mean, I was just talking to Pam McKinnon about it, who directed an amazing revival, Steppenwolf, with Tracy Letts and Amy Morton and Carrie Coon. I forget the guy who played Nick. Wonderful production, and that revealed new things about the play that you can't say that Albee didn't intend them, but they certainly were. It was a new take on George and a very new take on Martha. And it was not about race. I know there are some playwrights who really feel like this is all we have is the rights to our work, and this is part of it. And you hear, I think you can make an argument, maybe it's a sort of contrarian argument, that play is, and a lot of plays that we say, they're not culturally specific. It could be any, and they are culturally specific. It is about, in a way, you could see it as a critique of white culture, the way appropriate is. It's like it's about white folks and how they behave to each other. But I do think that play is capacious. And I was talking to someone about some American classics like Streetcar and Salesman and ones like that have really become world plays. The world owns those plays. And there's other plays.
The estate also allows those plays to be performed with multiracial cast.
The estate has something to do with the estate opening up those plays. So I guess I would say I do think it's a missed opportunity. I can understand. Albee only died last fall, so I was a little amazed that there wasn't a memorial tribute to him yesterday. But anyway.
During the plenary.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we lost a kind of a giant there too, but whatever.
Oh.
That was all theater leaders, I guess, but not playwrights.
We had nothing to do with that opening event, by the way, folks.
So what about you, Amy?
So I sort of have two thoughts about that. The first is that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf always seemed to me as a period piece. Mm. And so, you know, the setting, it's this little tiny college town, you know, it's a period piece, and it comes from that era and it comes from those demographics. So there's that. On the other hand, as a person of color who loves theater, I remember the first time I saw another Asian person on stage. Mm. And it just blew my mind, because until then, it didn't seem like something that we were allowed to do. And just having that validation of seeing someone who looks like you on stage. Until then, because my experience in theater was, my first exposure was like so many people reading it in school. And so reading it a play static on the page instead of seeing it in the flesh. And my first exposure was Shakespeare, like a lot of other people. And so it was this thing that Dead White Men did to me. And it was this lost or fading art to me. And I didn't realize how modern and contemporary and alive it could be until I started seeing plays on stage. And then started the first production by an Asian American playwright I saw was a David Henry Hwang production with cast with Asian actors. And it blew my mind. I'm afraid I've overused that phrase. Boy, I think it was the one about the railroad workers.
Oh, yeah.
It was a black box production on my college campus.
Oh my God. I'm trying to remember
it was
what
signature Workers recently, on the Railroad. Yeah. I don't remember the name of it.
Yes.
Dance on the Railroad.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So there's that. And so you could take that back to that first thread about Albie's, you know, very much being about white people in a certain time and place and era. And you could rebut that by saying, yes, but the essential theme of that play is about a marriage falling apart. Yeah. And that crosses all cultures and races and ethnicities.
I just think it's so interesting because when I wrote my article about the whole controversy, like I was also researching these controversies around Tennessee Williams and how people are very angry about like certain diverse casting within Tennessee Williams plays recently, such as The Glass Menagerie on Broadway that had an actress in a wheelchair on Broadway playing Laura, and so many people, including several major New York reviewers, New Yorker, New York Times, were very distracted by her casting and quite offended by it. And they're saying, like, Tennessee Williams didn't intend for the character to have an outward disability. Her disability was always inward and always in her mind. But it was just, for me, watching it was just so powerful because how often do you see like that, those kinds of bodies on stage, and how often do you see them struggle and also like just move through the world and how they move through the world? It's like very beautiful and very, I want to say shocking, like for shock value, but everyone just always looks so perfect when they're on stage and on screen. And so just putting the imperfections just right out there and having us as audiences deal with them, that was beautiful. And so it then made me wonder, like, whose right is it to say, like, who can say, like, what the intentions of these playwrights were?
I mean, within a certain, the legal answer is states can. But, the argument is that did change the play, but I think the play could handle it. It was a different play. It should be a different play when you do it again. I would just add that I did see Andrea Fry at Oregon Shakespeare Festival in 2002, and she was great as Martha. And it didn't radically change the play; it gave it a new dimension. And she was great.
Well, speaking of Oregon Shakespeare Festival, they also did a production of A Winter's Tale, which was correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was A Winter's Tale that was resituated in an imperial Chinese court.
Yes, Desdemona Chiang directed it.
Yes,
it was amazing. I knew a couple of actors. I saw that. It was cold when I saw it. It was October.
So you have the same imperial and royal intrigue themes, but set in imperial China.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, none of those places that Shakespeare wrote about were, you know, quote unquote, aside from the history plays in Romeo and Juliet, they weren't like, quote unquote, real places. And so they can be anywhere, and they have been anywhere.
I think now they definitely could say they could be anywhere. Yeah.
So I guess like wait 100 years and we can do whatever we want to Albee and Tennessee Williams and Miller.
I want to see Eva Van Hove's production of Virginia Woolf. No, I want to see other ones. No, I don't know if I do, actually. So this is an interesting conversation. Are there other themes that come up a lot in the theater here that are worth drawing out? Trends or local artists that you would want to tell us about?
Maker Theater?
Oh, Maker Theater. We should talk about that. That's our theme of the conference.
I can't really call out specific theater companies because then I'd be accused of bias.
Of course you can't. That's right.
What I enjoy is just the energy that you see in a lot, because we have a lot of smaller companies. And, you know, one of the big issues, actually, that we did a story earlier this year that I was pretty happy to get in the paper. One of the issues that a lot of theater companies are facing here is the red hot real estate market. So, you know, and it's not unique to Portland. It's a lot of places that are up and coming now are facing these same issues where there's just this real crunch for space. You know, companies are losing their homes, or they're just having much more difficulty finding venues. The silver lining to that is that we have these smaller companies that are just more nimble and agile. And, you know, they can operate. They don't need the giant facilities with the proscenium stages. They can work in smaller spaces. They can come up with more creative solutions. One company that was profiled in the story, it actually came up with this solution a while ago, but it's a great one. They partnered with a local school district to use their facilities. And then, of course, you have other companies that do have facilities and are more in more stable financial situations that serve sort of as a home, a hosting home for smaller companies. So I think all that crowded, cramped condition has actually led to a fairly collaborative feel in the theater community. When I talk to theater directors here, artistic directors and other folks, I say, you know, when I first took the job and had to look into the theater scene more closely than I did previously as a patron, I said, so tell me what it's really like. Are you friends on the surface and you're really cutthroat below, or is it really as collaborative as it looks? And the answer was that you have to be collaborative because you're using a lot of times the same venues. Many actors rotate among companies in town, to get jobs and to work on productions. Same with the behind the scenes folks. And so it's really collegial. I mean, once you start talking to one or two people, you find out that you're quickly meeting everybody else. And you see that a lot. There's a lot of support and rapport.
Oh, Amy, you were talking a bit earlier about representation and how important it was for you to like see an Asian American face on stage. And so like I know for me as an Asian American journalist and editor, like what I like to see is diversity, and I like to see things I haven't seen before, and it kind of bleeds into what I like to cover and what I want American theater to cover. And so like since you're the head editor of the art section, like do you try to insert a little bit of that aesthetic into it, or like do you know like that's your bias and then you just like try to counteract that? Like what's your, how do you balance that?
So my reaction was kind of we do kind of a best bets or picks, you know, our picks column every week, and we were freelancing that for a while, and then for various reasons that particular freelancer decided to stop doing that column. And so we were looking around for someone to do it, and I said, oh, I'll do it. It's not a big deal. It will actually help me in my job because it'll force me to pay even closer attention to what's going on. And then pretty much as soon as I took it over, I did have that mwahaha moment because I realized that if I was in control of writing the column, I could make sure that at least one of those picks represented artists of color every single week. And so I've tried to stick to that as closely as possible. And I think it's been a win-win because our readers have been introduced to artists that they may not have known about because we haven't been covering them or even looking for them earlier. And it's not that I will put something in there just for the sake of having somebody in there, but I'm looking more carefully and more purposefully, for diversity and inclusion.
Do you ever have to like read over people's copy to be like, hey, you shouldn't say that. That's probably racially insensitive or gender insensitive.
I see things sometimes that, you know, if I had written that copy, I wouldn't have worded it that way necessarily. I recently came across a phrase that referred to a white person discovering Asian art. And I changed that.
Did you change it to?
This person, the reference was to a person who had grown up in a home with Asian art. And so I just changed it to the facts. The person was surrounded by Asian artworks.
Great.
Right. He wasn't Columbusing Asian artworks.
He didn't discover it from out of nowhere, right? Yeah. All right. Gotcha. Amy, this is great. If there's anything else you want to, you know, you can name the company that collaborated with the school district. That wouldn't be recommending them. What was the company that crowdfunded?
That was Broadway Rose Theater Company,
great.
Tigered.
Great. Yeah. Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
No, total pleasure to have you. Our next segment.
Oh, yeah, give us a clap.
You can clap. This is a live podcast. Sorry, we're a little rough around the edges here. So our next guests are Damaso Rodriguez, Artistic Director of Artist Repertory Theater, and Maureen Porter from Third Rail Rep. I'll just move over to a different mic. great. Thanks for coming up.
Thanks for, having us.
Yeah. Coming here. The idea was to talk to two artistic leaders of different, totally different theaters. Did I get that right? You're totally different, right? I know. One of you is large and one of you is small. One of you has a large home, and one of you is itinerant right?
We're very different in terms of time, in terms of scope and scale. We're
right.
Certainly very different.
That was the idea.
Yeah. That's well for well sure. Done. Well done, then. Then check.
So tell me, Dama, so starting with you, I saw your work in L.A. at the Furious Theater Company, so I was aware of you when I was covering theater in L.A. Then you moved to Portland in 2004, is that right?
No.
More recently than
I've
that.
I've only been here almost 4 years.
Almost four years.
Up my fourth season as artistic director at Artist Rep, and we announced our fifth, and we're on our way.
And we wrote a story about Artist Rep's long dreamed of hope to become a LORT member, which I'm not sure, we all know what the LORT member is and what that means. It has big economic implications, and it's a heavy lift. Mm-hmm. I don't know, we have to revisit that story, but tell me a little bit about how Artist Rep has changed just since you've been there.
Sure. Well, we're going on to next year is our 35th anniversary. And I mean, I inherited a company from the artistic director who had been there 25 years. Right. So by the time I got to Artist Rep, I was the beneficiary almost 30 years of building a company from nothing. It was started by actors. They built the sets themselves. No one was getting paid. And by the time I got here to Portland, Artist Rep was at that time the longest running, it was the longest running professional theater. There had been others that had come and gone. Mm-hmm. Artist Rep kind of grew. And, in 2004, we bought a building. We occupy this tiny city block. We have two theater spaces, three rehearsal halls, tons of administrative space, a lot of it undeveloped. And so one of the biggest things that has changed that when I got here, for a lot of reasons, including the recession, the theater was dark about half the time, I would say, the theaters. Okay. So it was kind of a months of quietness without a lot of activity going on. Occasionally, we would reactively have renters and programs and things. But we made it a choice, the managing director, Sarah Horton, and I, to activate the building as much as possible in the spirit of almost that it was ethically wrong not to, share the space with a community that needs space. And
right.
So we ended up in the last couple of years adding to our missions. Our mission is basically to produce intimate, provocative theater. We have two relatively small theater spaces, about a couple hundred seats each, and we kept that as part of our identity. As a reference, I think, to our roots, and the ability gives us the ability to do challenging work still, even though we've been around for a long time and have a few million-dollar budget. Mm-hmm. But we added to provide a home for artists and audiences to take creative risks. So the board embraced that as part of the mission. So then we have been able to fundraise and staff up on the premise of a program that we call the Arts Hub. And Arts Hub is essentially looking for resident companies that are at various stages of their development.
Okay.
They occupy our space. We have 11 resident companies now that use the spaces in different ways. And then we're still producing our seven-show main stage season and our presentation series.
Those kind of rentals, or they're not rentals? Or they're,
we call them residencies.
Residencies,
because
okay.
Really, like, so imagine Artist Rep is in there rehearsing a play from 10 to 6, even though it's perhaps inconvenient to that rehearsal room, we'll move our stuff out of the way, and in the evening it'll be classes or a company that rehearses in the evening.
And Profile is one of those theaters,
yeah, Profile
right?
Theater.
Yeah. I interviewed Josh Heck the other day about Profile Theater. I was going to ask you about your mission, but you already answered that question. So, by contrast, Maureen, what's the mission of Third Rail Rep, and how long have you been there?
Third Rail was founded in 2003, and I moved back from New York and became a company member, I think, in 2005. The underlying mission is actually from our start was to be an artistic home for audiences and artists, and to really inherently in our mission was a desire to provoke dialogue, encourage empathy, and inspire curiosity through exceptional storytelling and through an ensemble. So that's the heart of it. I came on board as an actor. That's my background. I'm an actor. But the company, the underlying value of the company is really leaders among equals. It's about leadership among, so there's a less hierarchy, or there has been traditionally less hierarchy. And so somewhere along the line, as an artist and a person who tends to step up when there's a need or if there's a vacuum, I tend to be a person who will fill it. I have moved my way until just very recently into the managing artistic director position. So I have kind of an eclectic and not a traditional path to this.
The title managing artistic right. director is the two.
It's the acronym is MAD. So that tells you something.
Yeah. It seems like picking up on the theme that Amy mentioned was about real estate. You are itinerant at the moment, right? Did the Rail Rep did have right. a home and they don't anymore?
No, we've actually never had a home.
Oh, really?
I think
okay.
fundamentally when we started, there was a sense that what we wanted to do was instead of being attached to either a building or the charisma of a single artistic director, that it would be the company and the work that felt relevant and necessary to bring forth. That there was, you know, that was the, and, you know, theater starts, ideal theater, right? I mean, it starts with an ideal.
Right.
And then there's a point we sort of exploded into a really into success. And we never wanted, we didn't, in those early years, didn't want to, you know, buy, we didn't want to have a mortgage. We didn't want to
right.
be facilities managers.
Right.
And at that time in Portland, that we didn't really need to. It was less expensive. There were more performance spaces. We felt like people could track our brand and identity pretty well.
Right.
So over the course of the years, I counted up that we've been in 9 separate locations between performance and office spaces. And it is the tension, the stakes are growing, of course, every year, because now in the development of this city, what's happening is people are developing, condos and retail and completely sterilizing lots of neighborhoods from having any cultural anchors of any kind.
Right.
And it's too expensive for people. I mean, I don't think that the problem for arts organizations is like a separate entity from the problem of people who can't afford to rent a house or, we have a problem that we're trying to face. So we continue to be in an increasingly, tenuous position about what will space mean and the cost of it and trying to keep that.
Does it make you want to become buy your own building at some point, or you just get the headache over with, or no?
Well,
no.
I mean, yeah, it's a good question. I wish I had a good answer.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing about that is that then you become, I mean, yes, in my dream, if
yeah.
I had a dream,
okay.
the thing I think would that we would, as a city, there would be increased municipal support and subsidy of some sort for cultural anchors and cultural organizations, and subsidized housing for people would be really a part of the plan front and forward, that we would be able to utilize some of that and work in a collective, as Damaso has spoken to so well. There are so many companies that need help. So we actually thought, in our ideal world, if we could get into a collective situation that wasn't necessarily 5 like performing arts organizations, but let's say an arts through education, a social justice, a visual artist, a theater company, and then maybe a devising company that does a different kind of work and doesn't need the, same sort of traditional subscription season, and that you would activate that space and have it fundamentally available to the community in a way that would, be vibrant and relevant. But just the idea, a few years ago, we thought, yeah, wouldn't it be great? We'll do a capital campaign. We'll buy the building. It'll be ours. That'll be so awesome. But then you hear from all the stories that you take on an enormous amount that actually could drain your energy from mission. From
right.
So it's a question we're weighing, I guess, right now, Rob.
So, Dama, so what keeps you from being drained of your mission, having a building? No.
No,
I'm just kidding.
They are clearly mission
deep. I'm just kidding.
It's very draining over
yeah.
the building. I mean, we just had yesterday there was an air conditioner that overflowed and the office, the
right,
ceiling
right,
tile
right.
caved in with water.
Hey, when that happens.
That's life.
No, but I wanted to ask, do you feel supported by the city, or do you feel like some of these real estate tensions are also a pressure on you, even though you have your own
building. We have a building, but we owe on the building. We have a mortgage.
Right.
We still owe $3 million on our building.
Yeah.
We're pretty public about that. So we're still figuring out how to arrive into this real estate development we went into. The buying of this building was a, you know, getting a mortgage was a step toward a goal that we have to achieve, which most of the theaters and arts organizations that are established in this country don't really pay a rent.
Yeah.
Right. So the sort of most robust and well-funded arts organizations are paying a dollar a year or something on a 100-year lease. That's typical. Yet the smaller organizations are paying exorbitant weekly rent or, in our case, trying to live up to the ambition of this space. I still think it's the best move we've ever made, because having space allows you to focus. In my opinion, you know you have a place to work.
Right.
Yeah. And then you set yourself, upon overcoming the obstacles in the way of making the work or the kind of work that you really want to do, but you're not trying to just find a space to create. That's done.
Yeah, it's like being a freelancer. You're having to hustle for the job. You have to hustle for the space every time you want to put up a show. But that can be a creative challenge, right?
I suppose. Right. I mean, constraints, I guess, in any sense could be construed then eventually as an artistic challenge that gives birth to something.
But one thing that caught my attention about Third Rail Rep, just in the little that I know about it, that you do National Theater Live screenings at your theater?
We do. That's we present broadcasts that are captured live at the National Theater, and then we present them here. That was really born out of the our founding artistic director, Scott Yarbrough. His love for theater and certainly his passion for directing came out of his time in London and his relationship to the theater there. And so it was an idea he had as a way to generate some earned revenue and to present the programming, bring that programming to Portland. So,
Do your own shows or your own aesthetic resonate with the National Theater in some way, or is it more just an audience perk?
I think it's more like a perk. I think our main stage productions tend to be different. Yeah.
Right. We were talking before the broadcast, Dama, so that you had a chance, the opportunity. You were planning your season, and the ink wasn't dry yet, and the election happened, and you were able to move a few things around and program it a little differently than you might have given the political moment. Is that right?
Yeah. For us, we open a season in September and run it through June. And that means that the plays are getting shortlisted, almost finalized in November, December. That's the race to the finish to try to have your season lined up. So we had not set a season when the election happened, but we were doing it in the weeks following the election. And what ended up happening was every year we evaluate. There's always like, what's the context of next year? Do we want to change? Because you could always change your programming a little bit, or even the number of shows you produce. That is one of the benefits of having a space. We can kind of define our future in that sense. We have subscribers, but there's some wiggle room as to how we move forward. And so the stakes just went up in terms of why are we doing the work that we're doing? Why are we raising the money to do this work? Why are we going to work so hard to build an audience for the plays? It just sort of, you start I think of each of the plays at our budget levels like a couple $100,000 project, right? Well, what do you want to invest your time in?
Yeah.
Plays that matter, that are urgent, that need to be done. And I would say we tend to do that kind of work through our history. We do provocative plays, but we also will do a couple of classic, kind of, more softball titles to that kind of warm you up and soothe you an audience, and that maybe pays for your more challenging work. Or
right.
I wrestle every year with the obligation of a Christmas play. Like I hate being, you know, and if you know my background at all, I ran a company in LA called Furious Theater, which was an edgy little theater company.
There's no holiday show.
No, and people would walk out of our plays. And so that's my background, and I've grown up in the regional theater, and I was at Pasadena Playhouse, and I do all kinds of work. But my instincts are still there, and I don't want to be pushed into a commercial decision.
Right.
And so, again, in partnership with my managing director, we said, let's just be as bold as we really want to be. And the truth is, you hear it at this conference, there's the audiences are stagnating or going, you know, are dwindling. You know, theater is less relevant than it has been in the past. And so the standard formulas, especially for, let's say, a regional theater where you program it a certain way, you have that classic title to justify this title, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily working. It wasn't necessarily working for us.
Right.
So it just, the election just gave us a little confidence. It's just, let's just do it truthfully and in a way that we can really believe what we're doing, because we believe these are the plays we want to invest all of this collective energy into.
Right.
And that's what it was. It just said, you know, it was sort of like, what are we here for? Let's put it on the stage.
Right. Okay. I guess I should ask you, this is the season coming up next year, the one that you're in the midst of.
Next year.
Next year.
So we go into it in August.
Can you tell me? I mean, we published it, but maybe just run
through
it.
Sure. I mean, we're doing Brandon Jacobs Jenkins in Octoroon. We're doing Christopher Chen's Cot.
Right.
We're doing The Humans by Stephen Karam. We're doing Between Riverside and Crazy by Stephen Knight Lagurgis. We're doing Larissa Fast Horse's The Thanksgiving Play, a world premiere.
Okay.
We're doing I and You by Lauren Gunderson. And
nice.
We're doing the world premiere of E.M. Lewis, who's an Oregon-based playwright's six-hour epic, Magellanica, which is about a 1985 Antarctic expedition to study the hole in the ozone layer.
Wow. That's a season.
That's a good season, man.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have to remember that, right? And I guess, Maureen, I should ask you likewise, what's coming up for Third Rail Rep on the boards?
What the season is, actually?
Yeah, sure.
So our season this year, we are much smaller. It's a much smaller group.
Yeah.
So we have four main stage shows. We're opening with Lungs by Duncan McMillan, David Grieg's The Events, which is a play that we're excited about in the way in which it incorporates a different community choir, a local community choir every night that actually engages and interacts with the performance. And then I'm new in this position, so then my passions start to rise, which are really about diverse women being on stage. In our season this year, we have 20 contracts, I think, 20 roles, and 16 are for diverse women across lifespan, race, ethnicity, experience, shape. So it's just fantastic. And this is where my passion begins. So we're doing Jacqueline Bachhaus's Men on Boats.
Oh, wow.
Which is I read it a while ago. And I had a company in New York. I was involved in a company in New York called the Queen's Company, all female, all the time, no apologies.
Yeah.
And it's sort of where the coals of the fire that burn in my, because I'm an, you know, again, I'm an actor from, that's the founding passion of my life. So to put 10 women on stage feels like a radical act, which is absurd, but true.
Right.
So I love that. And then we're doing Alice Birch's Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again.
Oh, wow.
Which, and we're casting that actually with, it's where she gives you some room in terms of numbers, but we're actually casting it with one man and four women. And again, just absolute diversity across lifespan and in every way. So,
wait, are you one of those 10 people going to be on Men on Boats or no?
I'm directing Men on Boats.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. And then I think I actually will end up on stage for Revolt, she said. So I can be in it.
I confess that I did not research your seasons. These are amazing seasons that I just to hear about. I want to just ask you, you could talk specifically about Portland or nationally. Like, what gets you up in the morning to do theater, and what keeps you up at night? And we can talk about, just keep it to theater, not your personal life, whatever. But.
You go, Damaso.
No. It could be politics, too. We can go there if you want. Or politics as it relates to your leadership at the theater.
Well, I was going to answer the first question.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's that exchange that happens when the audience is there. So when you've assembled the play and the house is full and there's something electric happening and people are responding to the work, that's what gets you up,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what keeps me from sleeping, keeps me up is the sustainability of what we're doing, you know, it's about money. Money is what keeps me up, right?
Raising
money. And I think, it was said earlier that, some of these organizations that have homes, you know, are financially robust and strong. You know, that people, I used to perceive that from the outside as well. But when you get inside, it's like all of our theaters are are having the same challenges, just a different number of zeros in the budget, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that way, back to the beginning of this right. conversation, that's how I know we're similar, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Right. I remember talking to Sarah Horton, who's the managing director, and she and I were having a conversation about a session we did here, and she said, you know, for many of the problems, she was like, well, you know, add a zero, or, you know, and then it's our problem. You know, it's like
yeah.
there are similarities that we're dealing with in terms of space and expense and money funding. I think one thing that can do you want?
Okay. Yeah, I want your answer, too.
I agree totally, because the thing that does keep you upright, like not keep you up, that keeps gets you up and makes you so excited is the thing that can really happen in theater, that sort of visceral, remarkable, we're experiencing something in real time together. That is so profound and it's amazing. The thing actually, and I'm this feels like a little bit of a dangerous thing to say, particularly since this is going to be recorded, but one of my questions is, given the world right now, I say to myself, is the work that you want to do in relationship to social justice and change possible in the theater? And I think it is, but it keeps me up at night sometimes anyway. There are a lot of ways in which theater in this country remains kind of at a distance from many people. And I think it is potentially a bridge. There's a way in which it bridges. But there's a lot of work to be done around that. And I'm leading an organization that had a founding, you know, artistic director. There's a lot of change, and it's really difficult, because one of the things I kind of want to do is unapologetically overcorrect for the white male paradigm a bit. And then do that authentically. And that is a complex, you know, thing. And I sometimes think, I'm saying to myself, if theater is the way, then what does that look like?
Right.
And that keeps me up.
Is the main challenge in realizing that kind of a goal, the internal challenge of making it happen with the artists, or is it the audience, or is it both?
Like, I think it's all. I mean, yeah. I think that notion of the personal, the cultural, and the system, right? Those, you know, the layers of the kinds of bias we carry around, the world that we live in. I think it's all of it, which is, I guess, why it feels deep.
And Dama, so you think your audience is going to follow you down this? They're not going to go, where's our Christmas carol? Where's the where's importance of being earnest, man? Come on.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Should we
reconvene next year?
Find out how it went.
I think that our core audience, I mean, we have a lot of audience members that have been coming to the theater for 35 years. So they were with us through all kinds of work, and I think that base will go with us. I think we're going to have to find an audience that's just waiting, that hasn't been coming to the theater, in order to really support this work.
So yeah. you don't feel like that? I feel like sometimes I've heard anecdotally that sometimes we maybe underestimate how much long-time theater goers are really adventurous. They're actually like, I don't want to see another Shakespeare. Give me something different, right? Yeah. They might be really, they're literate, they're educated. Now that's within certain
I get that feedback a lot. And then I also
get the other feedback.
Right, right.
Yeah, I wouldn't overemphasize that. I guess since you both came from, you came from New York, or did you grow up in Portland?
I grew up in Portland,
and then
moved away and then came back, yeah.
I guess I would just want to close by asking about what you feel about Portland, how it fits into the national scene, or and what you think that, you know, the what's great about working here and what's challenging.
Yeah, well, I think one of the great things that about working here is that it is this incredibly beautiful place with a community still small enough to be engaged, so that you really can both collaborate with your colleagues, and that the audience is there and connected. I think that there is definitely a core of loyalists who are follow the theater. I think and then having places like Artist Repertory Theater and, you know, and specifically, I will say, when I saw their season, I wrote to Damaso immediately and was like, yeah, right? Yeah, do that season. I mean, it's that is really exciting. And to have Artist Repertory Theater here committed to those values and leading us regionally at a you know, because Third Rail, no, outside of Portland, people don't know us at this point.
That's all going to change.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah, that's all right. Now, here it is. But there is a way in which there is a healthy ecology of the sort of big, and Third Rail wants to sort of stay in that smaller, mid-sized section. And then a lot of companies producing that are smaller and, you know, rough and tumble. And so I there's a lot about that that's great. However, the growth and the popularity of this Portlandia image, a lot of people are moving here who I think have means but are actually not really necessarily yet showing up to invest in the culture, not just the like food and the great that you can go out to the Gorge, but like what else is happening.
Right.
And you know, the fact that we have a, we do have this legacy of white supremacy in this state, starting before it was an actual state. It is in our world. It is, and we have to be consciously, you know, working in relationship to that problem, which is a problem.
Right.
And it directly relates, as far as I'm concerned, to the art we produce and how we make access. So, all right.
Yeah, well, I'll speak to Portland as what I think is a theater scene. I think it's an exciting scene. I think it's one that's not really it doesn't have a national presence yet. Right. But today that changes on off-script.
Yeah, exactly. You've made it.
And the conference, but I do think the conference is a bit of a moment.
No, that's true.
For us as a city, and that's why we're so excited to have the conference here. Being here just 4 years and never having been to Portland until I was a finalist for this job.
Really?
Right? A lot of it was, and that process went on for 8 months. So I was getting to know this community that I might want to move to.
Yeah.
And I still feel like I'm studying the scene and trying to see a lot of, I should always be seeing a lot of theaters and artistic director, but I'm still in that, oh, I haven't gotten to that company, or I haven't been to that space in a while, and so I'm out there seeing a lot of work. My survey of it is just it's a cool scene. Of course, the Broadway tours will come here in the Keller Auditorium. So you get that. Then you have Portland Center Stage, which is producing 10 or 11 plays a year, and it is the flagship, large scale Lort Theater. They are 3 times larger in budget and physical space than Artist Rep. Okay. And then Artist Rep is 3 times larger than the next Portland based theater.
Okay.
And you have this, I think, really, kind of unique to Portland, very entrepreneurial, very well organized group of theaters in that several hundred thousand dollar budget range that are producing great work seasons. I feel like it's again that maker culture. You see it in all the way down the line in companies. So even very small startup companies that are, you know, people maybe getting out of college and staying here and doing some work, or moving back after grad school to do some work in the Northwest, they start with fundraising principles, and they kind of study the marketing materials and the press releases of the bigger companies. And so there's a kind of an organization that is here, and I think it's unique. A friend of mine said, who was in Chicago in the 80s, said, Portland reminds me of Chicago in the 80s in terms of its potential.
Wow.
And the kind of vibrancy of the scene for such a small market.
That's cool.
So we often close our podcast when it's deep, and Susie and I and other folks, with recommendations of things we've seen, things we're reading about, things to think about. We have not seen anything in Portland. We're here only for a few days. So we thought I'd turn it over to you to ask you. You can recommend a company. You can recommend something that you want us to think about. We've got a lot to think about talking to you, but Maureen, why don't you start?
Well, the thing that comes to mind, which I think is, I hope it hasn't already happened, is Hands Up, August Wilson Red Door Project's Hands Up is tonight.
Tonight.
You absolutely should see that. Absolutely.
So tell me about Red Door Project, since this podcast will go out after that tonight's performance, or is that ongoing?
Right. No, they're ongoing. You know, their mission is to change the racial ecology of Portland. And Kevin Jones.
Through the arts.
Through the arts, yes. Thank you. Right. Through the arts. Their programming, they're involved with the August. And actually, they're a resident at Arts Repertory Theater. So just to connect that. But they do the August Wilson monologue competition here locally, take students, and just. just are doing like doing the work in a real way. And I actually think they have changed the racial ecology and the way in which this community speaks about issues of race. So August Wilson Red Door Project, that's would be my first recommendation. I have I have a bunch of other ones, but
that's great.
I'm just going to shout out to some companies.
Yeah, go for it.
Portland Playhouse is another great company in this midsize. I'm going to shout out Carb Theater because they're great. But Gemma Whelan, the artistic director, came to this podcast. She's in the house.
Come to this podcast.
Many Hats Collaborative. Is that you, Jessica Wallenfeld, sitting in the back?
I love her too.
There's a Broadway Rose and Tigered came up. They're doing really good work and growing as an organization. Just like they're another big company in town now, I think. TCS, Portland Center Stage, doing great work. Mojada, which is coming from OSF. The production of Mojada by Luis Alfaro is at OSF right now, is coming to Portland next year, and it is special.
Heard great things
extraordinary
about that.
Piece.
And in Portland, I mean, as long as we're going to shout out, I do think a couple are Portland Experimental Theater Ensemble, Pete.
Shaking the Tree.
Shaking the Tree, Samantha, who's here and is amazing. There's so many. Defunct Little Theater does great, courageous work.
Bag and Baggage in Hillsborough.
Defunct is with a K, right?
With a K.
Yeah, right, okay.
And Coho Productions, which has a very specific model in Portland, unlike anybody else. And that's their Summerfest and their main stage, definitely worth
Can I also
out.
Call out Milagro Theater, which
is
one of the leading Latino theaters in the country, and it's been around for 33 years.
Yeah. No, I think these conferences are like a brigadoon where we come together once a year, a little village of theater people. But it's a different village every year. And you know, this is our introduction. We're not just going to swoop in and go, "Nice to see you." I hope that we'll be covering Portland Theater with a new attention, and now that we've seen your faces and seen your city, we'll have a new perspective on it. And all this in Legal Weed. So, on that note, I'd like to close another episode of Off Script. There'll be links to all this. Thanks for coming out today. Thank you, Tommaso and Barnes.
Thank you.